Hi, we're the Canadians, and we're here to save you. Save you from mediocre coffee. That's right. You don't even need to leave the safety of the embassy to get it. I'm talking about Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer a variety of blends and roasts, including decaf and half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend. But what makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to you in Canada or the U.S., within just 1 week of custom roasting it here in Canada, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. It's completely customizable, flexible, and there's no commitment. And because you're a top 100 listener, Sparkplug is offering you 20% off your next order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Would you storm an embassy for Sparkplug coffee?
Yes.
Well,
which embassy? Where? Let's go now.
Americans and Canadian embassies probably have it. They could now. Maybe not back in 1979.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, fans of films that are about fake films. And thank you for stuffing Ellis's Analysis episode number 433 into your ears. The Top 100 Project has been looking back at classic movies for so long that our initial quest to review all 123 AFI greats on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists was completed more than 6 years ago. Fair warning right now that we will be spoiling this movie today, and we might spoil many other flicks too. I'm the Shah of Toronto, whose target audience will hate him, i.e. people with ears. Kevin Harkins. I mean, Tony Mendez. I mean, Ryan Ellis. And here's the best of the bad options, by far, we have on this podcast. My wife, Bev.
That's me!
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, the second one in the 7th annual Oscar month, the Best Picture winner from 10 years ago, Argo, fuck yourself. Ben Affleck did not win a Best Director Oscar for Argo. A movie that, of course, did win Best Picture, but at least he won an Oscar for producing it, along with George Clooney and Grant Heslov. Since the year 2000, how many other directors won an Oscar for producing their movie, but didn't also win for directing that same movie? I hope my trivia, by the way, last week leading into this was clear. I didn't mean somebody who won an Oscar as a producer, but was a director some other point. I meant of that movie.
The only one that's coming to mind right away is Farrelly, but I forgot to look this up, so who am I missing?
He's one of them. There are three. You didn't like one of the movies, you loved one of the movies, and you didn't love the third one. You just said the third one that we didn't love, but there's some elements
of Green Book. One of them's got to be The Artist, right?
Nope.
Oh, no. He got nominated for
Michael
Best Director?
Michael Hazanavicius, or whatever his name is, he won for The Artist, not just nominated.
Oh, God. Jesus.
So the first one was in 2005. Paul Haggis didn't win.
Oh, he didn't even get nominated, or he just didn't win?
He did not win Best Director, but did win for producing that movie.
Did he get nominated for Best Director?
Yeah, he got nominated. He won for writing and for producing. Steve McQueen for 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, yeah, that's a crime.
Along with Brad Pitt and many other people, won for producing that movie.
Who won? Ang Lee won for Best Director that year or something?
That was the first one for Cuarón, Gravity.
Tough to take it from Cuarón, a director that I love, but sorry, I think
McQueen
Steve
probably should
McQueen
have won.
Should have won.
And then Peter Farrelly for Green Book is the other one.
Eh, should not have won. Shouldn't have won Best Picture.
Haggis
definitely
and Farrelly,
not director.
Haggis and Farrelly also won for writing that night, so they won two awards in the same night. Affleck went for producing. But Affleck wasn't nominated for Best Director. Affleck's one of the few people that ever directed a Best Picture winner without being nominated at all. We've covered maybe all of them now. Grand Hotel, we did just last week. Edmund Goulding, no other nominations for Grand Hotel.
Let me guess, is it Driving Miss Daisy?
Bruce Beresford, we covered
Ayo.
That. We covered Green Book the year it came out. We've covered all the Best Picture winners the last 3 or 4 years. Later in that year, we'll do the same this year with whatever wins. And then Affleck was the fourth of those people. Could happen this year, because there are 10 nominated pictures, only 5 directors, of course. But the other thing about Affleck is he won the DGA, but wasn't nominated for Best Director.
I know.
That is extremely rare.
Yeah. So, Ben Affleck, Paul Haggis, and Farrelly. Is it Peter Farrelly? Which,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Three people who all have more Oscars than Martin Scorsese.
Farrelly does. Affleck has one for writing as well, Good Will Hunting,
yep.
Which we'll cover in a few months, probably. And what was the third name?
Oh, I guess Haggis only has one. No, you said Haggis also.
He won
also.
Two.
He won two. So all three of them have more Oscars than Martin Scorsese. Three, I'll say it, mediocre filmmakers.
Affleck of those three is probably the best one. Although the Farrelly brothers in their heyday made some really funny movies.
When they were in their lane, even as I say that, Green Book was not a poorly made film. No. Not even close. It was a well-made, dumb movie.
It's the pat on the head for a white person to see that one other black person who's extraordinary is a human being. And if that's what it takes to convince people who otherwise would be racist, maybe not to be racist, then that's a good thing. But it's a pretty small step in 2018. And also, a great year for film. And that's the one you guys pick as the best of the year.
I know, it's a crime. We found the one black man worthy of our respect. Applaud us! Anyway, listen to our podcast if you want to hear me really go off on that movie.
Yeah, Green Books in Our Archives, 12 Years a Slave is... We might redo that next year, be the rare redo, because we redid Citizen Kane in a way. We re-edited it, basically, and added some modern thoughts, I think 5 years after we posted the podcast. But 12 Years a Slave we did as a now-playing project, and we didn't even mention Lupita Nyong'o, who won the Oscar, because we didn't know who she was. And she was very good, but she didn't stand out. I didn't think, sorry, at the time. Look what she's done since. So we maybe should redo that next year in this exact same month.
Yeah, the podcast that we did was one of the episodes where we were just doing like a quick off-the-cuff reaction of a movie
because
we had just seen it.
That night for that one.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to this one.
Cool.
So Ben's Great Escape saw the light of day at many film festivals. That was released by Warner Brothers 10 years ago on October 12th. 2012, and it did have the old-fashioned 1970s Warner Brothers logo on it, which was fun to see. The movie did extremely well. It was one of the biggest hits of all the Best Picture winners of the past decade. So you mentioned a bunch of them. We've talked about them in the last 5 minutes or so. The Artist did better than that. 12 Years a Slave, better than that. Spotlight did better than that. Moonlight did better than that. Argo was actually a hit. But Bev, the movie is now 10 years old, so you probably should remind us what it's about and give us a skinny on Argo.
It's 1979, and conflict has erupted in Iran, where the Shah has been overthrown by revolutionaries. They've stormed the U.S. embassy and taken all the Americans hostage, except for 6 people who escaped and took refuge in the Canadian ambassador's home. Ben Affleck is Tony Mendez, the CIA operative tasked with the near-impossible rescue mission. He creates an entire fake film to allow them to pose as Canadian filmmakers scouting locations in Iran so they can get on a plane and go home. The mission is difficult and risky, but with preparation, teamwork, and a lot of luck, they pull it off.
Or, in a nutshell, hooray for Hollywood! Hooray, hooray, hooray for Hollywood. Da, 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 da,
da, da, da. It was a year that did not have a lot of really standout...
That's true.
...lovable movies. There were some controversial movies that were well-reviewed. Probably my favorite movie of the year, Zero Dark Thirty. Fair to criticize that movie. There's lots of things that you could pick apart about the ethics of that movie that I couldn't argue with. I think that the voters just decided to go with the movie that made Hollywood look like a big old hero.
The previous year, it was a movie about movies with The Artist.
Yeah.
Shape of Water. They love movies. Not so much a movie about them.
But a movie about a movie lover. Mm-hmm. Look at one of the worst things to ever come out of the mind of Martin Scorsese, the movie Hugo, although you disagree with me on that. To me, an objectively bad movie that got so much praise, but it's like, oh yeah, because... It just had tons and tons of love for Hollywood.
The year before this was nominated for Best Picture and many others. It won some technicals. He was nominated for Best Director. And between Hugo and The Artist, I would rather Hugo had won. But that was not a great year for Best Picture nominees. Moneyball is the best of the nominees.
Agreed.
Here are the 9 nominees from 2012. Amour, Beast of the Southern Wild, Django Unchained, Les Miserables, Life of Pi, Lincoln, Silver Linings Playbook, and Zero Dark Thirty. Obviously, Argo is the 9th. Amour I saw with a friend as a download. We saw it at home, and he wouldn't shut the fuck up, so I should really watch it again. Maybe we'll cover it later this year. I really don't know that much about it. I know it was a pretty good movie from what I could tell, but during a foreign film, please stop talking.
In my opinion, and you know I love Zero Dark Thirty, I think Amour is the only great movie on this list.
I've never seen that a second time, Beasts of the Southern Wild a second time, Les Mis, I'm never watching that again. Let's see. I think I've seen everything else. I've never seen Lincoln a second time, even though I do want to. It is Spielberg. Life of Pi, I bought that. That might be the most impressive movie of all of these. It won Best Director. We've covered Django Unchained, by the way, and, of course, Zero Dark Thirty. They're the two movies from 2012 in our archives. But my favorite of all those nominees is Silver Linings Playbook. I don't like it as much as the first time I saw it, but I still feel like it's the best movie. But I didn't think it should win. It's just that if I had a vote, I would have probably voted for that. Great acting in it. It isn't as powerful when you see it a few times. It's funny, too, because at the box office that year, the three movies we've now covered from 2012, Argo was 22nd, Django Unchained was 12th, and Zero Dark Thirty was 32nd. So 12, 22, and 32. Rotten Tomatoes numbers on this movie, 96% of critics say Argo is good. 8.4 out of 10 was the average. 360 reviews, so a very fair sample. And 90% of audiences. Roger Ebert, this is the last year he did a top 10 list, had it number one. And Life of Pi, the Best Director winner and some technical awards that won the night, was number two.
Uh-huh.
So this film won 3 Oscars, we know Best Picture, but also for the screenplay by Chris Terrio and the editing by William Goldenberg. I think I said to you that night, it has to win for the editing of the script, because the only other major nomination it had, and it didn't win this though, was Supporting Actor. And realistically speaking, you have to win at least something from acting, directing, what have you, to also win Best Picture, which is why Nightmare Alley this year cannot reasonably win. It has one major nomination, Best Picture, but then 3 technicals. So anyway, Argo did win for the script and for the editing. It was nominated for Supporting Actor, Arkin. I think John Goodman was as good as Arkin was. Arkin was fun, but he'd won before for Little Miss Sunshine. I would love to see John Goodman get recognized as much as him. Cranston was also very good in this movie. Also for the sound effects, back when there was a separate category, it isn't anymore, and the music score by a guy we saw on the Oscar stage a lot back in this time frame, Alexandre Desplat, who I believe has 2 Oscars, and he was nominated this year for this movie. This is the last time Jack Nicholson presented Best Picture. He did it 8 times, which is more than anybody by quite a lot.
Yeah, wow.
And really, in a way, it was Michelle Obama.
Yeah, that's funny, because in my memory, I was like, oh, sure, Michelle Obama gave, but he physically gave the statue because she announced Best Picture from the White House.
He came up on stage and they said, we have a special guest, actually, and from the White House. And then she was live, and then she's the one that actually opened the envelope and said, Argo, congratulations.
I wonder if they did that on the chance that Zero Dark Thirty could win, because
her husband,
Bin Laden's assassination was one of President Obama's biggest wins when he was in office.
Might have been, I don't know. So you said a minute ago that Amour is the only great film of the nominees, of the 9 of them.
Truly great film.
Okay. Zero Dark Thirty was a movie you liked a lot. Maybe your
probably
favorite.
Probably my favorite film.
And I know you also like Silver Linings Playbook quite a bit,
too. I enjoyed it a lot. Like you, watching it a second time didn't do it any favors.
Okay. That's a weird year, though, because apart from Les Mis, which I hated, these are all pretty good movies, but this is one of those years that nothing really truly stood out. Maybe that's why Argo won. My favorite movie that year, and favorite is the wrong word for this, but The Invisible War, the documentary about rape in the military.
Mm.
That's a powerful film. I've seen it at least twice. I'll probably watch it again someday, although that's not a fun one to get through. It's a Schindler's List, irreversible Passion of the Christ kind of thing where that's hard to do, and that's a compliment to the movie. This isn't a hard movie to watch. It's actually very palatable. Ben Affleck's made 4 movies. His first was Gone Baby Gone, then The Town, which we loved. I think we both loved or liked a lot, right? And then we heard a podcast.
Yeah, so true.
The spoiler special that Slate does. Dana Stevens and whoever she talked to.
They just tore it to shreds.
And they weren't wrong.
So true. We both had the exact same experience. We were like, oh, man.
Damn it, shut up. But you're right.
So stupid. Oh, you're right.
But it was entertaining at the very least. The Town was. Gone Baby Gone certainly was. And Live by Night, not so much. That's his worst movie of the 4 so far. The other 3 are extraordinarily entertaining. Really good casts. This has a huge cast, and that may be one reason why Affleck won in the end, for producing it at least. It's exciting, but it's not really a thriller in the Zero Dark Thirty sense. It's more of a thriller in the All the President's Men sense.
So I have a little pet theory about how this movie won Best Picture. It got nominated because there's 10 nominees, and it was just
9,
in the pile.
Actually.
Yeah, 9, but you know what I mean. Got nominated for Best Picture, and he didn't get nominated for Best Director, and everybody thought that was such a dig. Everybody really felt sorry for him. Bizarrely, the only time in history Ben Affleck
was
the underdog. Everybody was suddenly rooting for him. He is a man that has been hanging on to his popularity by his fingernails for most of his career. He's almost lost it several times over. But this is the one time in his life that he had the public's goodwill, that everybody was feeling bad
Goodwill
for him.
Hunting, they had the goodwill too.
Oh, okay, fine, fair. But after that, let's face it, he's been fighting tooth and nail to keep the public from hating his guts. There's just something about him. He just does dumb things and has like a very douchey persona. So everybody felt sorry for him. And then he started sweeping everything else. If there was an outstanding movie, this would not have happened. But you have a bunch of votes that are probably spread out amongst the 9 movies. And this was just the thing that put it over the edge. Everybody was like, hey, why did he get jilted out of his Best Director nomination? A lot of actors are voters in the Academy. They could have seen the slight and then said, well, hey, my fellow actor can direct just like I have things to think and say about movies, and I'm going to vote for him, because how could you undervalue an actor like that? Who knows? We'll never know. But I think that the sympathy vote pushed it over the edge.
It had to be a factor. I only read this recently, and he apparently said, I wasn't nominated for Best Actor either, so that was also a slight. But in a good-natured way.
He meant that
funny.
That's a good joke.
As a funny thing, right? And that's just said a minute ago that as good as Arkin is, nomination-worthy, that's fine. I'm not against that. He's probably as good in this as he was in Little Miss Sunshine, where he won. So if he hadn't won for that, maybe he would have gotten the vote for this. This was the year Christoph Waltz won for Django Unchained. But he already won before in a better performance in Inglourious Basterds. So
yes.
If Arkin hadn't already, this would maybe be the time he'd get that lifetime achievement and a good performance type thing. But I prefer Goodman. Cranston's quite strong in the movie, too. The people that wouldn't have gotten nominated, but they play the, I was going to say Canadians, but the Americans in the Canadian embassy. Victor Garber, who is Canadian, playing the ambassador. Smaller bit parts. They weren't going to get nominated for Oscars. But you've got people, and this is our first time covering Philip Baker Hall. Small role for him. Bob Gunton is in this. Kyle Chandler, Titus Welliver, who was in a lot of Affleck movies at this point.
Small parts, mostly.
Richard Kind, George Clooney's old friend.
Yeah.
The voice of Bing Bong in Inside Out a couple of years after this. But the six, I'll call them the six, include Tate Donovan, Clea DuVall, Scoot McNairy, Rory Cochrane, fairly decently well-known actors as well. All solid, believable performances. The funny thing about this movie, though, including Affleck as Tony Mendez, Cranston, Arkin, Goodman, the six, the ambassador, the Iranians themselves, we don't really get to know anybody in this movie in any real way. It's about 2 hours. It's got a fast pace. I don't want to say it's too fast, but it's a funny movie in that sense that I cared, but I barely know these people.
Does anybody have a character arc in this film? You maybe could argue that Tony has a character arc, but I would say it's contrived and really poorly executed. There's this whole thing with his son. He loves his son. He misses his family. He wants things to work out with his wife. Great. But what does that have to do with the secret CIA mission he's on? And how is it resolved at the end? I might argue that going on a dangerous CIA mission that you're not allowed to tell your family anything about might serve to further alienate you from them. But we need to pretend that Tony went through some kind of character development, so we put these familiar elements there to trick you into thinking there's depth, but it is completely surface and phony.
He finally comes home to Taylor Schilling. He wasn't known really at this point, I don't believe.
It was before Orange is the New Black.
I thought so.
Yeah.
So she has no lines. And the character doesn't need to have lines, I guess, because we never see her otherwise. We see the son a little bit. He has some phone dialogue with his dad. And at the end, they're together again. But the implication reminds me of Courage Under Fire. Denzel's wife in that movie tells him at one point, go away, don't be around us until you resolve your problems, which is dealing with the case you're dealing with your own past in the Iraq War, and also stopping drinking so much. You're an alcoholic. And I think that movie's saying that when he comes home, he wasn't kicked out, but if he's going to go home, then those things are in his past, he dealt with them. So that's probably why there's no language in that movie that says, oh, great, I forget his character's name, Denzel, you fixed all of this. Maybe this movie is doing the same kind of idea that if he actually goes home, but then his wife doesn't know what he did. No one can know. He wins an award, but there's no ceremony, and it's never official until many years later because Clinton, I believe, or was it Bush, declassified this case.
I think it was in 97, so that would make it Clinton.
That would be Clinton.
So does he have a drinking problem? Because they seem to only introduce alcohol as a shorthand for this is stressful and hard.
Ben Affleck gets a drink in this movie in a big time way.
We never see him drunk. It doesn't ever appear that his drinking is getting in the way of doing his job in any sense. This movie is full of a lot of cheap screenwriting tricks.
Because maybe Tony Mendez wasn't even a drinker, but maybe Ben is subconsciously telling us, I can drink as much as I want to, it doesn't affect my job.
Okay, maybe
Ben Affleck.
But it still doesn't do anything for the character. They're not implying, or maybe they are, that he's an alcoholic. They never come back to it in any meaningful way. It's just a cheap shorthand for them to say, he's stressed out.
Pouring another drink
and looking out the window and grimacing.
Well, the bigger issue, though, with this character is the whitewashing. Tony Mendez, of course, Hispanic, dark skin, probably my height, 5'7", 5'8". Affleck is tall. They have that one scene where he's in the Middle East and he towers everybody else and he's white. Yes, he has a beard and dark hair and Affleck isn't pale exactly, but he still stands out. And the whole point with Mendez is that the look he could fit in the Middle East. I'm not saying Hispanic people look like they belong in the Middle East, but more so than Ben Affleck does. So that's one of the elements of this movie, too. And I don't know if they only got it made because they cast, was he even a star anymore? Maybe. I guess you could say he's an actor. But then he'd made good movies as a director. And maybe he was already on the way back up into the light. Hollywood loves the comeback story. He'd been shit on, deserve it or not, for many years. He talks about that in the Oscar speech. You can't hold grudges. You can't. It's hard, but you can't hold grudges. But he directed two really good movies before this. Despite the town's flaws, I still enjoy it. So maybe that's one of the answers, is that the studio, Warner Brothers, weren't going to give Affleck as a director the movie to make unless he cast a star, i.e. himself. A lot of people who've directed movies, generally, in fact, they direct themselves when they do something early on in their career. This isn't that early on for him, I guess. But Mel Gibson didn't want to be the star of Braveheart. But in the end, he was. And I don't think it was an ego power play, believe it or not. I think it was more a matter of, I don't have to pay myself anything to be in this movie. And they want me to be in this movie. Fine, Paramount. I'll be William Wallace, even though I'm probably miscast. And Affleck is too. If that's not the argument, I don't really know why they didn't find somebody who makes more sense for the role.
Well, he's cast himself in every movie he's made except for Gone Baby Gone.
And it was his brother.
Where he cast his brother, and you could argue, well, it was his very first movie, maybe he just didn't want to direct and act. But many people say Gone Baby Gone is his best film, so maybe there's something to be said for just doing one job at a time on set.
Funny thing about Affleck is that he's been humorous, enjoyable, funny in plenty of movies, like Good Will Hunting, for example, and some of the early stuff. Even when he played a bully in Dazed and Confused, he's fairly funny. But he's also pretty believable, little one note, when he plays these dour characters. I think he's quite solid in this movie, maybe even a little bit better than solid. It's a good performance. And I loved him, and Chris and I talked about this last year in The Way Back, which he just did right before the pandemic. It came out. It didn't get much attention and then was gone from theaters because everything was gone from theaters. But he is terrific in that basketball movie. Another guy with an alcohol problem. A movie he didn't direct, but I thought he was very good in that.
You think he's terrific in Argo?
No, he's terrific in The Way Back.
Do you think he's good in Argo?
I think he's at least good.
Okay.
Solid.
I feel like
miscast.
Yes. This is a movie that has this amazing, crackling pace, and yet I feel like he manages to bring the mood down in every scene he's in.
The dourness.
He's just so joyless and dull. And this is a man who has exhibited tremendous charisma. We know he's putting this on. And like I said, all he does is take another drink, look at the window, and glower. And I don't feel like I got anywhere near inside his head and what his character was actually feeling and thinking. He was just there to kind of look slightly distressed about the fact that everybody's naysaying all of his suggestions and everything's just so darn hard. Oh, sigh, take another drink, look out the window, and glower. And I don't think his performance was that great. Although I will say, I watched an interview with the real Tony Mendez. Mm-hmm. That is one of the most charmless men I've ever seen on television. No offense to him, not everybody's amazing in the camera, but he could be one of the dullest people I've ever seen. I would imagine the biggest challenge for those Americans stuck in the embassy would have been staying awake while he was trying to give them their instructions.
That bad, huh?
It's so bad. He was such a poor speaker. And again, maybe he was just nervous on television. He's clearly a very smart and capable guy. And maybe he's not like that in other situations. But it does make Affleck's performance perhaps a little more authentic.
Okay, well, yeah, because if he had met Mendes, and I'm pretty sure he did, he thanked him during the Oscar speech as well. He's playing the character as he knew the guy. Is the interview new or newish?
No, it was when the movie came out.
Well, new in that way, not from 1979 or 1985 or something. Then, yeah, he probably was always like that. But then maybe something was wrong with him as he got a little older. Maybe he was sick. Maybe he wasn't completely healthy.
And TV cameras can just make people nervous, too. But
well, CIA,
not a crackling personality.
CIA operative does not have to be good on camera, exactly. So that may be part of the factor there, too. You set this up by saying, of course, the overthrow of the embassy in Iran is the whole storyline. The important thing, too, and they added this after the Toronto Film Festival, just like they actually have a credit at the end thanking Canada, and then Jimmy Carter saying it was really Canada's mission way more than America's. And Affleck was generous in mentioning Canada, as he should have during the Oscar speech. But they do say in the opening that the U.S. and the U.K. deposed the previous guy, then the Shah, Khomeini, however you pronounce that, the Ayatollah. Maybe he's still in power? He was for a long time. Let's put it that way. That footage, of course, is real stuff. Most of it, anyway. But I thought the footage we see when we see the day where they overthrow the embassy was a mix of real and footage that they shot. But then I read online that it wasn't. They have that one shot where a guy's got a flag. And I think he's burning the American flag. And it's grainy and all that. And then the camera shot comes down and it looks like a proper film shot again. And I figured that somehow they, and I should have realized they didn't, because that would have been so hard to do, but I figured maybe they just re-shot the same looking guy. But I guess that was all their footage, other than the stuff that we know for sure was actual historical footage. So even more credit to the filmmakers, Affleck and everybody else involved, for making it seem like it was from 1979.
I think that might be the best part of the movie, the part where they're attacking the embassy. It's an incredible tension.
As for the 60 left in the U.S. embassy, Argo, fuck them.
Seriously? This movie treats them like they are nothing. Who could possibly care about them? There's one scene where we see unnamed people being dragged into a basement, treated as if they're just about to be executed, guns pointed at their heads, and then click, there's no bullets in the guns. Ha ha ha, joke on you. They're all freaking out. Terrible psychological torture. Then they just cut back to the six who were like, gosh, how are we going to get back to America? And they spent 2.5 months in Iran waiting for rescue. These people spent 1.5 years being held hostage by people who were actively torturing them. This is an interesting story that's worth telling. And I'm not sure how they could have better handled the idea that there were people who were suffering far, far more than these six who managed to escape. But the way they do handle it just seems glib.
It almost seems like don't bother showing them even that one scene, because that scene's also cross-cut with the script read. Because as Alan Arkin's character says, and he's based on a real producer because this really did happen, John Chambers was the makeup guy in the original Planet of the Apes, probably some of the sequels, but definitely the first one. They say that he has a history at the CIA, too. So this isn't a first-time deal.
Tony Mendez was a master of disguise, so he probably worked with him to disguise his appearance on certain missions.
There you go, right. Chambers is a real name, Goodman's character. Lester Siegel is a composite character, so not a real person, but he is based on a real producer. Reminded me so much, by the way, of Dustin Hoffman and Wag the Dog. This is nothing.
Totally.
Also steals the movie, and both of them are nominated for awards for these characters. Hoffman, leading actor, probably should have been supporting, and Arkin for this. But I do like some of the lines that Arkin has early on. We're going to need a script, and if I'm going to make a fake movie, it's going to be a fake hit. They have that script reading because they need to make it seem like it's real, and that does become relevant in the storyline. Maybe not actually in reality, but in this movie, those storyboards and the fact that they've got ads and Variety are probably some of the main reasons why they were allowed to go through on that plane. I was reading that's not legitimate. They left really early in the morning. Nobody was giving them any trouble at all. It was actually a worry-free extraction when they finally did. I'm sure some of these things were real in the sense of them being afraid, and I think when I film scouts, or at least one of them, in that bazaar, we see that scene, and it looks like there's going to be trouble there.
That never happened, though. They never went to the bazaar.
They didn't?
No.
Okay, not true then also.
Yeah.
But the end, when it's wheels up, and we can drink now because we're no longer in Iranian airspace and everyone celebrates, it wasn't anything close to as terrifying as the way the movie portrays. Although, I remember when I saw this movie the first time, I think I saw it without you. You must have seen it later on. I feel like I saw this alone. That I was definitely in, because I didn't know if it was real or not, but whether it was or not, I didn't really care. Are they going to get away? And if they don't, they're going to be killed. This isn't just, oh, you're going to go back to the embassy, or you're going to go to the American embassy that now belongs to the Iranian citizens who have weapons and are torturing their friends and colleagues. It's, you're going to die in the tarmac.
Yeah, yeah. Much like the town, though, you have these really tight, fun action scenes that you enjoy in the moment, and then think about for 5 minutes after the credits roll and go, oh, that's stupid. There's no way.
Well,
and when you look up what really happened, it's stupid. There's no way. There's so many things that don't make sense. They're chasing them on the tarmac when they could just pick up a phone.
That plane comes back. Even if it lifts off, it's coming back.
Yeah, exactly. They're still in Iranian airspace, but if they know they don't want the plane to take off, it's a phone call. The plane doesn't take off. What would they have done if they caught up with them in the cars? What, are they going to pull in front of this speeding airplane? It doesn't make any sense. But, you know, when you're in the moment watching the film, you're just buying it. And I agree. I bought into it, too. It's a well-crafted film. It's really well-edited. It has an excellent score. And as much as that script is full of cheap tricks, they really threw the kitchen sink at trying to make everybody invested in this incredibly invented story, especially by the end. And it works when you're watching the movie.
In the moment, yeah.
In the moment.
We can pick it
watching
apart
it
now.
This the second time, I was going to pull a muscle rolling my eye so hard at a couple of times. The only part that is apparently real is they make this big deal about the form that they have, the paperwork, how it has to have the yellow corresponding paperwork to get them out of the country, and that they really were there sweating bullets whether they were going to get through that particular point. And the guy got up and he left and he was just getting a cup of tea. That's the most tense thing that actually happened to them in the airport. But like you said, they went very early in the morning. Tens of thousands of people can go through an airport in a given day.
And
just because
pretty good cover stories.
Yeah, just because they're Caucasian, they're Canadian, there's people from all over the world. They're coming in of an airport, and they just really didn't raise any red flags. The plan went off without a hitch. I'm not against a movie that's based on a true story contriving conflict. They're all going to ramp up the conflict. They're all going to fudge the story to just make a better film, to get audiences invested and make it entertaining. But I would compare it with Zero Dark Thirty, that had a very similar scene where they had to show a CIA mission And I'm not sure exactly how accurate it was, but a lot of people say that they stuck very close to the truth. It didn't go
SEAL Team 6, you mean? The actual mission to get bin Laden?
Yeah, it was a very well-researched scene, and it was pretty close to what actually happened. And in the scene, it goes off not completely without a hitch, but pretty close to without a hitch. A couple things go wrong, but they handle them right away. They get in, they get out, they complete their mission. They didn't have to invent any dumb contrivances to make us invested in the story. They just shot it well and edited it well. It's one of the most exciting things I've ever seen in a film. To me, that's the crown jewel of that movie.
And we knew where it was going.
That scene. Same with Argo. These are two movies
That was only a year later. That was
everybody
a far more well-known story.
Intimately, lots of people who saw that movie probably read all the articles that described exactly what happened. SEAL Team 6. People already knew the nitty-gritty details, but you watch that scene, and even if you know everything that's going to happen, no matter how many times I see that movie, God, I'm at the edge of my seat. It's so well-made, and they didn't need to insult my intelligence with this dumb car chase on the tarmac.
Okay, two things then. So Apollo 13 is always the one I use as a benchmark for, oh my God, the chute's going to open, they're going to live. I know they did anyway. Not that Apollo 13 was that well known to me in 1995 when I first saw the movie, but I think I had heard they did survive, and I'm still invested after all these viewings in the movie. So you're right, Zero Dark 30 is at least similar to Apollo 13 on that level, and Argo doesn't make that work as well.
And Zero Dark 30, for the record, there are plenty of things in that movie that are contrived, that are composites, that are fudged to make a more interesting
movie. But the mission
movie
is immaculate.
Full of more conflict than it probably had. But that mission at the end, which to me is what makes the film great, is pretty accurate.
The other movie I want to compare it to is another Best Picture winner, Casablanca. Because as Roger Ebert points out, we talked about how this is a favorite movie of 2012. Casablanca, you said in the commentary for that, at the end about the whole letters of transit, that's the whole storyline. That's the MacGuffin of the whole film. The Nazis don't care about your letters, whether it be Bogart using them or Paul Henreid using them. Henreid's character is also somebody that they want to capture, torture, and kill. It doesn't matter what he's got, whether it be money, gold, letters of transit. If they find him, and they do know where he is, but it's a movie, so you don't really think much about it. I hadn't thought about that until Ebert said it in the commentary. I thought, yeah, you're right. Why would they really care about being official? They've murdered so many people already. They're going to murder more. They don't care about official documents. You could argue the same thing happens here. I also read that the guy that they're struggling with so much in the airport before he lets them on the plane, you know they get on the plane, but again, if a movie sucks you in, you wonder if he's going to let them go. And I guess when Tony first lands there, you see him in the background arresting somebody, giving them trouble, what have you. So he's a very suspicious guy. But in reality, of course, none of this happened because they got in the plane without incident. Maybe the bigger bogus thing in this whole film, but you buy it at this point if you like the movie at all, Tony's conscience gets the better of him, and that's fine. We've seen that in many movies. It gets the better of Bogart in Casablanca. But he's been told it's now a military mission by Cranston's character, Jack O'Donnell, who's second billed in the credits on IMDb. O'Donnell says it's going to be military. Tony Mendez is in the CIA. He doesn't outrank O'Donnell to begin with. He certainly does not outrank the military. And he absolutely does not outrank Jimmy Carter. But he says to O'Donnell, we're responsible for these people. That's the night before. And then when he calls them the next day, I'm taking them through. He hangs up the phone and then goes to get them early in the morning in Iran. And O'Donnell realizes, well, if you hang up the phone on me, okay, fine. We got to help him do this thing. And that's pragmatic on O'Donnell's part. And it worked. So maybe that's why Tony got away with it. If this is real, any of this is real. But he's been told by his boss, they're going to do this their way, as bad as that may have worked out, but he doesn't listen. That to me is more of a fantasy than the actual ending, which I know was a fantasy too.
Well, you know how he got away with it.
Because it worked?
Because it's all made up. That is another thing that is a complete invention of the film. They went back on the mission and decided to do a military thing and then changed their mind again. But all that happened before Mendez even entered the country. They would never have left him high and dry in Iran like that anyway.
They might have left an operative high and dry.
I mean, I guess so, but they didn't. None of that happened. Also, the whole plane ticket thing, that they're waiting for the plane tickets. The plane tickets were purchased by the Canadian ambassador's wife. And she bought them 3 sets of tickets on 3 different airlines, just in case.
Okay.
These were all contingencies that were taken care of. They were not flying by the seat of their pants. It was a very well-planned mission.
I guess originally the 6 went to different embassies as well. They didn't go to the Canadian embassy right away.
Oh, yeah, there's this
but that was just making it so
that.
It's more compact. We'll get to that point.
Fair. There's a line in the film that Cranston says, Britain turned them away, New Zealand turned them away, the Canadians took them in. That's not what happened. They stayed, I think, in the British Embassy for a few days before they considered it too dangerous because they were too much of a target to the Iranian revolutionaries. New Zealand didn't take them in, but they helped them get to the Canadian Embassy. And they all worked together to take the best option, which happened to be the Canadian Embassy. So they were maligned unfairly, insinuating that they were just leaving these people high and dry, but that's not how it went at all. It took them days to get to the Canadian Embassy.
And the CIA gets so much credit for doing this, Mendez and O'Donnell and everybody. But it was different embassies, and of course it was the Canadian Embassy, and you got Carter literally saying it, although it's many years later. Really, it was the Canadians that did all this, and I think it was something like 10% of the plan was the CIA and the Hollywood thing. It's funny to hear the president, however many years later that was, saying that. It wasn't 50-50. It wasn't more us, but yes, the Canadians helped. It was more, we were there. We were more support. We being America. And we're Canadians, so we want credit for that.
Just like Hollywood wants credit for it.
Now, I talked about it a minute ago about how vivid the opening is, and I thought it was actual footage that Affleck then matched. I guess it was all new footage. When they do storm the embassy, they burn documents, and they take hostages, but these six get away. It reminded me so much of a movie from about 8 years before, Dawn of the Dead. And I'm not saying the Iranian characters are zombies, but just the way that they storm through, almost matter-of-factly, it almost seems like if the ambassadors, the people in the embassy had weapons, wouldn't have mattered. They didn't react as fast as they probably should have either. And then later on we see that the pictures they shredded, the things they shred, documents, but the pictures in particular of their faces, meticulously, very slowly, like that scene in Batman Returns, a lot of tape and a little patience goes a long way. The guy at the airport sees one of their faces and realizes, oh my God, no, let me get in the car. We're going to try to stop that plane rather than calling and stopping the plane that way or bring them back after they have taken off. But anyway, all this stuff is pretty vivid. The Iranians are just a mass of people, apart from a few of them here and there. And I don't really have a problem with that because we've seen that done before. They don't need to have individual characters, but they do come across as terrifying. And who can blame them for being terrifying under the circumstances? They wanted the Shah back. Oh, this part I can't really get behind, even if they had a good reason for it, to hang him. Maybe a trial, justice, not just, let's kill him.
So the film received criticism from Iranians for failing to portray the many Iranians who wanted to free the hostages, including most of the cabinet members, apparently. The entire country of Iran was not a frothing-at-the-mouth mob, zombies, as you say. Affleck's kind of low-key.
Well, the movie is what I'm talking about. I don't mean the real thing.
The movie does not give any of these people motives or personalities. They really do come across as just like a frothing, writhing mob. And not just when they're literally a mob, but the scene where they go to the bazaar, it takes nothing for this entire crowd.
Pictures? Pictures? No pictures? Fuck you!
Okay, in fairness.
Or go fuck yourself.
I lived in the Middle East when I was a kid in the 80s, not too long after the events of this movie happened. When they're in the bazaar and they're taking pictures, you would never do that. Nobody who'd lived in Iran, in the Middle East, for any period of time would dare take a camera out and start photographing people. You could get arrested, and now mind you, this is Saudi Arabia I lived in, but you could get arrested for taking pictures of buildings. Photography is flat out illegal in Saudi, and it's certainly not cool in a lot of the Muslim world. There's this attitude in fundamental Islam that photographs, I don't want to say they steal your soul, but it's something like that where they just consider it incredibly taboo to take a photograph. So nobody who lived in Iran would ever take a photograph in public like
that. Oh, hang on, actually. They're supposed to be scouting locations. They just got there.
But they would still not do something that would attract the ire. They all lived in Iran for months and months.
They're not supposed to. They're supposed to be from Hollywood.
Okay, fine. Canadian. It's a cover, but they still would know better than to attract that much attention.
They're Canadian filmmakers working with Hollywood who are scouting locations, which does require pictures.
Okay, but they're also not idiots that would want to attract a pile of attention. But no normal person would know that. Fine, the movie writes that in. But you say, oh, he's taking pictures, it's overreaction. I don't know if it was an appropriate reaction, but they should certainly know better than to take pictures in a country like that.
So easily the best part of this movie, though, is the hooray for Hollywood part. Arkin and Goodman, great team together. Wish they had done more films together. This, by the way, was the second straight year for Goodman in a Best Picture winner because he is in The Artist also as a filmmaker. And then who was it that was in the next year's movie? Maybe Scoot McNairy? Yeah, he was in 12 Years a Slave the year after that. So he got this linking device for several straight years. But Goodman, Arkin, and then when Affleck's with them in Hollywood and some of the other characters they deal with, by far the most fun part of the movie, easily. The laughs come there. And I really do think that's the big reason why the movie won Best Picture. Hollywood loves to salute itself.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still amazed, actually, that Sunset Boulevard didn't win Best Picture over All About Eve, because All About Eve is a great movie. And it's not a bad choice to win Best Picture in 1950. But Sunset Boulevard is about movies. Maybe because it's negatively about movies.
Also, All About Eve is the theater, which is very movies adjacent, and it's essentially about actors. Most of the voters are actors, right? They make up the biggest majority of voters in the Academy. Plus, it's, well, I mean, in my opinion, it's a better movie, but Sunset Boulevard is a pretty great film, too.
But anyway, this is a movie about movies. The storyboards are very important. I love when the Iranians actually keep them and, oh, I got this thing. And you don't know what they're saying unless you speak Iranian.
They think it's neat.
Persian? Sorry, whatever the language
Farsi,
would be.
Farsi.
Farsi, that's it. Yeah. And it looks like they're a little starstruck. But the scenes actually in Hollywood are the most fun. I assume you agree?
I like them fine, but that's one of your favorite things to see in a movie, right? You have a real soft spot for movies about movies.
When it's done well, yeah.
I kind of felt like the tone shift is a little abrupt, because you're going from a situation that's so serious and dire to these two people who are like, go fuck yourself. I hate that phrase. It's so dumb. Sorry, I'm really dumping on this movie. I should probably say some things I like about it soon. But it's not going to be the Hollywood stuff. Sorry. There's some stuff in there that's fun, but it just feels like a breakneck tone shift to go from Iran to Hollywood. And in Hollywood, they're so irreverent about the whole thing when it's an incredibly serious thing. They seem so put upon about the whole thing. And now you're being heroes. You're saving people's lives. Maybe
I think they're working for free. Maybe that's part of it.
Okay. Guys, I did like some stuff about the movie. I'm really dumping on it. It is, as Ryan said, incredibly watchable and fun. I do love the siege on the embassy. That's, to me, the best part of the film. And a believable incident. I'm sure that they fudged some of the details there, too. But it just doesn't feel as silly. I don't feel like I'm being talked down to in those scenes. And even though you have this enormous cast, they may not have a lot of character development, but you do get these really fun and sometimes powerful performances out of really small parts. And just in general, it's so watchable.
Yeah, I think having a huge cast like this is a big reason why someone would get recognized. Well, he didn't get for directing, but why the movie itself would be recognized.
Affleck just cast every actor in Hollywood so they would all have to vote for the movie.
Crash did the same thing.
Yep.
Well, speaking of that cast, we've covered Affleck twice before, Shakespeare in Love and Dogma, a year apart from each other. We've covered Bryan Cranston three times before, even though you think of him as a TV star. He's a legend on TV now. Not just for Breaking Bad, and not just for Malcolm in the Middle, but also for that show Your Honor, which had some flaws, but another strong performance that he gave there. But we've covered him in Saving Private Ryan, a small role, but he's in that. Little Miss Sunshine, with Arkin.
Oh, yeah. They don't have a scene together.
In either of the movies, they have a scene together. And also, he's got a more important role in Contagion, another huge cast, with Affleck's buddy Damon in that one. Alan Arkin we've seen in Edward Scissorhands, and we did cover Little Miss Sunshine. Goodman we've covered four times before, but it's been a while. Four Coen Brothers movies. One of those was A Now Playing Project. Another movie we might recover next year to do it more thoroughly, Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, my vote to cover that movie again. I love that movie.
Because it was just a little Now Playing Project podcast.
And you want to talk about a great John Goodman performance. I think he's good in Argo, but when you see what he can do in a movie like Inside Llewyn Davis, his performance in that movie
he's tremendous.
Special.
Well, the best thing he's done with the Coens, I think, is The Big Lebowski, which
sure.
we've covered.
Oh, yeah.
Raising Arizona we've covered, and Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? And he was in The Artist the year before this. Blech. Victor Garber was in Titanic, Best Picture winner as well, and Legally Blonde, which we covered last year.
Garber was in Alias, wasn't he? And so he was in that with Jennifer Garner for all those years, playing Jennifer Garner's father. Maybe Affleck knew him because they apparently became friends on set.
Okay, yeah. I think he was also in something else Affleck directed, maybe The Town?
So maybe they're buds.
Could be. Tate Donovan was in Good Night, Good Luck with Clooney. Maybe that's one reason why he's in this film. Also, Damage is on TV and did some episodes of Friends. He is the guy who plays the director of the film. But he's not the one that gets them out of trouble. It's some other dude. He talks them through the storyboards. I think he's playing the production manager. Maybe that's one reason why it makes sense that he'd be the one to talk them through and say, no, here's what we're doing here, and this is what the movie's going to be there. And then they start realizing, okay, they're just filmmakers. We don't care.
That's a cool scene. I like that. Was he the one who was resistant? I can't remember because they're kind of interchangeable. So he's the one that fought them. And then that's the scene where it proves that he really was paying attention.
And
he really was
lives.
Doing his homework. He impresses everybody with his commitment to the part. All of his concerns were not about naysaying, but about his own survival. So when push came to shove, he did what was asked of him to improve their chances as much as possible.
And then Clea DeVal, Scoot McNairy, Rory Cochrane, they all look time and place. Well, Cochran's got experience with that because he worked with Linklater on Dazed and Confused, also with Affleck, and they all look like they belong in the late 70s. Kyle Chandler was in Zero Dark Thirty the same year as this, so two Best Picture nominees for him. Also The Wolf of Wall Street the year after this, which is one of your favorite movies of that year, and we did him in Carol.
We've covered four Kyle Chandler movies. Even though he's famous for being this good guy, this lovable dad coach type, I think he's the foil in all four movies that we covered. Not the foil in a villain sense, but in the sense that he's the bureaucrat, the authority, the cop, whatever, who's trying to be a big fat killjoy to our hero.
Harsh, the main character's mellow.
Yes.
Because the hero is not Leo's character in Wolf
no,
Wall
no. Kyle Chandler is actually the hero of that movie, but he is the main character's foil.
Yeah. Chris Terrio wrote various DCEU films and also The Rise of Skywalker. So mostly crap. But here he's got an Oscar for this one early in his career. He based it on parts of The Master of Disguise by Tony Mendez, an article, and also a Wired magazine article called The Great Escape by Joshua Bierman. And then the producers I mentioned, Affleck, Clooney, and Hesloff, who all won Oscars that night. So Affleck and Clooney have two at this movie, or one each, I guess. And then also one for Clooney. Supporting actor, though. So weird that this great movie star won for supporting actor.
Affleck had one of my favorite lines. One of the first things he says when he collects his Best Supporting Actor Oscar. I guess I'm not going to win for Best Director.
You said Affleck, Clooney said that.
Clooney said that, yeah.
The year he was up for Good Night, Good Luck for directing and for, I believe, producing or writing. Maybe
but
that's
he won
what
Best Supporting Actor for Syriana.
The movie's 239-1. We watched it on Netflix, so probably up there for a while. I think it's a fairly new addition to Netflix, so if somebody wants to watch it after hearing this, they should be able to. Rodrigo Prieto shot it. He's worked with Scorsese a lot in the last several years, including Wolf of Wall Street, and also shot Brokeback Mountain.
Stop, you're going to break my heart.
The editor who won an Oscar, William Goldenberg, cut Pleasantville, which we've covered, and also was nominated that same year for Zero Dark Thirty. And he tends to work with Affleck quite a bit when Affleck does direct films. And we already said Alexandre Desplat, who worked on Zero Dark Thirty that same year.
Oh, wow.
Grand Budapest Hotel we covered last year, and The Shape of Water. And I didn't write down which ones, but he does have, I think it's two Oscars. So he was involved in many big movies in the 20-teens. What'd you think of the cinematography, the cutting? I think you said you liked that. You mentioned you liked the score also, and I guess you can even mention the writing by Terrio.
I think the technicals are pretty good. Cinematography's a little bit too shaky handheld for my taste. Perhaps a little bit of overkill. It works better in some scenes than others. But overall, I think it's pretty good. It has a great 70s look. Production design does a great job of being in the 70s, but not beating you over the head with it.
The music choices maybe a little bit, meaning the original songs. I loved hearing When the Levee Breaks, which apparently Affleck really wanted in this score. One of my favorite Zeppelin songs. One of the great intros to any song as well. That
yeah. Keep going.
And I don't really know if it fits the scene he put it in, but he wanted the music in there, so it's fine. This is one of those movies that doesn't do it as badly as so many have, but it does really hit you on the head. But they'd be listening to 70s music, though, wouldn't they? So, okay, fine.
I do have to call out the script. You have a great story. Don't treat the audience like ADHD idiots that can't feel tension where tension exists. I guess audience members probably, if you've been listening to this for a while, you've caught on that dumb contrived conflict has become an increasing pet peeve of mine, and this movie's so overwhelmingly guilty of it.
That fits him in what happens next. We know the reality. We see some of it talked about, depicted. Text on the screen tells us all about it at the end. You can read up all you want to on it as well. But in a fun sense, what happens next? Somebody actually makes Argo, and fittingly, it wins Best Picture.
Yes! I love that.
Argo, you can't say it at the Oscars, in reality. Argo, bleep! Okay, our second Best Picture winner in Oscar month. We've got one more to go in 2 weeks. What are your last thoughts on Argo, fuck yourself?
It's just basic. That's why no one ever talks about it anymore. So, easy to watch, just as easy to forget.
We talked about our five favorite Best Picture winners from the 20-teens in one of the shows we've done. I forget when it was. And I don't think we even mentioned this movie. Or if we did, it was just shrugged off. We know that we don't like The Artist that much. We think that movie's quite stupid, really. But this is not one of the best Oscar winners of the 20-teens. It's one of the few we haven't covered, though, now, because we've done so many the year they won. So it's going to be impossible to do them 5 years later, like we've done with so many others or something, or 10 in this case. It's definitely entertaining, and Affleck knows how to ratchet up the tension. He showed that in previous movies. He makes you care about the characters, several of them, so many of them, but you don't really get to know them almost at all, including his own. This remains a rock-solid movie that I will probably see again, but I didn't think it was Best Picture material 10 years ago, and my mind has not been changed. In 7 days, we'll be embarking on our 7th annual Oscars Preview Podcast. This might be our most controversial episode ever, because we didn't like a lot of the movies from the past year that people seem to be raving about, including a lot of the nominees. I guess we'll mention some of our favorites, period, from last year, not just the Best Picture and other Oscar nominees, but we don't seem to be in sync with a lot of people that loved a lot of movies from last year.
It's been a pretty mediocre year for movies altogether. There's a lot of movies that I probably would say, yeah, they're good, but would never be thrilled to see win Best Picture.
The coming attraction's opinion question. The tradition leading into the Oscars preview shows is to ask what you want to see win Best Picture, so that's the question. What's your favorite of the 10 nominees? And of course, now this year and beyond, it'll always be 10 nominees until they change that again, because as we record this, they aren't going to have about 5 or 6 of them presented on the show. That still could change. I don't know what the point of that is.
You're just having a full-blown identity crisis.
Yeah.
All right, so for our answers to that question, please check out next week's podcast about the Oscars. We are not going to be hosting our website for much longer, so if you want a last-minute view of it, go to top100project.com.
Should be off the air, whatever you want to call it, by the 21st.
You can always find us wherever fine podcasts are sold, but actually given away for free, because all of our episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles, because we've been at this for a long time now, guys. In exchange for all this great content, please leave us a rating and a review. That helps people find us. And if you would like to find us, we are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And you can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. It's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Two more bits of housekeeping. I said the 21st. Well, that is a Monday. That is the day we release the Oscars preview number 7. So I will, along with anyone else who's curious about this, find out if nothing is there. I will be at work that night, I think. Anyway, I'll try to post the podcast one more time on the website, but it may not be there. So you got to go to our download options, which most people do anyway. The other piece of housekeeping is that Chris and I are going to do King Richard for our 99th Scoring at the Movies episode. 3 days from now, we release this Argo podcast on the 14th. He and I are covering that on Scoring at the Movies. Well, I want to thank my wife, who I don't normally associate with Iran, but I want to thank you for working on our marriage for 10 Christmases. It's good. It is work, but it's the best kind of work.
Well, not for much longer.
And there's no one I'd rather work with. That is what he said about Jennifer Garner during his Oscar speech that people still rip on him for now.
Is this how you tell me we're going to split up? Are we getting a divorce? And cut.
I will now go fuck myself.